I'd like to welcome you all for this topical workshop on cosmology, interplay between theory and observation. We'd especially like to thank the speakers who come from far and wide to lecture us here. We're very much looking forward to having a stimulating workshop. I won't say too many words, but I should stress that, you know, we have relatively few talks and a lot of time for discussion. So if you have any questions of general nature that are not directly related to the material presented during the talks, you should ask your questions during the discussion session. Now, talks will be recorded, and audio recorded, so I would like to request the speaker to also provide either the PDF files or copies of the transparency so that we can put them on our website. I also would like to thank the physics department, the Everett College of Science, Downsboro Endowment Foundation, and the Vice President of Research at Penn State for their support, which made this workshop possible. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Licia Verde from ICREA and
Well, thank you very much, well, for inviting me and for organizing everything for me and even for coming and pick me up at the airport, two different airports. And thank you for the introduction. So I was asked to talk about dark energy and related issues, and I didn't really know what to tell you and what you were expecting from this talk. So it's a little bit experimental, but since this is a workshop, and I guess it's supposed to be informal, it's probably going to be okay. So I think we've all been convinced that we and all chemistry are a small minority in the universe, and we don't know what 96% of the universe is, but what I'm asked to talk about, it's about this 73% of stuff that make up the universe that goes under the name of dark energy. And so we should remember that in the past couple of years, four important documents came out, and they will probably shape the observational cosmology for the next 10 years. And so what I'm going to talk about, if you haven't read this report, will probably help you to understand number 2, 3, and 4 of these reports, and I'll probably only slightly touch upon the first one, but the speakers after me in this meeting will go through the issues discussed in that report. So let's try to compare dark energy with other major discoveries in physics. And so these are a collection of major discoveries in physics: the constant of the speed of light, the discovery of the muon, the discovery of the omega minus baryon, the cosmic microwave background radiation, W and Z bosons, and, you know, since I'm from Europe now, I should put this in. CERN LHC is going to switch on pretty soon, and, you know, possibly something like that is going to come up. And I would divide these discoveries into classes, and the two classes are pink and yellow, and I let you think why I classify them this way. And then I'm going to add the dark energy, and where would I put it? So I'll probably put dark energy in there. Why? Well, the Michelson and Morley result was against the theoretical expectations, against the theoretical expectation of the theory of ether. And also nobody expected the muon, the famous sentence, who ordered the muon? But the muon does not challenge the theoretical frameworks. So the dark energy discovery is also against the theoretical expectation, in the sense that it will likely require a change in our preconception. And it's a continuation of the cosmological constant problem, that is, why is the cosmological constant that small? So the next thing, and that's probably the reason why we are all here today, it's because cosmological observation, we believe, can be used to test fundamental physics. And here is an extract from the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council report connecting quark to the cosmos that came up in 2002. And it says, in pursuing their own frontiers at opposite extreme, astronomers and physicists have been drawn into closer collaboration than ever before. They found that the profound question about the very large and the very small, that they seek to answer, are inextricably connected. The path of discovery for physicists now include telescopes both in the ground and in space. But not everybody agrees with this point of view, and this is, again, a sentence from an essay from Simon White last year, where he says, in this essay, I argue that this convergence can be damaging for astronomy. The two communities have different methodologies and different scientific cultures. By uncritically adopting the values of an alien system, astronomers risk undermining the foundation of their own current success and endangering the future vitality of their field. And I think this should be a discussion point, so I'm not going to say much more about that, although from the rest of my talk, you'll understand what my point of view is anyway. And I'll keep on going. So testing fundamental physics by looking up at the sky is not new. The interplay between astrophysics and fundamental physics has already produced some spectacular findings. Let's just only think about the solar neutrino problem. But what has happened recently is that cosmology has entered the precision era. And now we've been convinced that cosmological data can be used to test fundamental physics, and so far the cosmic microwave background radiation is the cleanest probe we have, but this view may be changed soon. We'll have to see what happens with the next generation of experiments. Now, there are four areas where this happens, and dark matter, neutrino, inflation, but I'll be asked to talk about dark energy, so let's concentrate on this. So, two big open questions in physics today can be answered almost exclusively by looking up at the sky, and the two questions are, how did the universe begin, and what is the nature of dark energy, and possibly related, at least in part, to the second question is, did Einstein have the last word on gravity? So, what I'll try to do, I'll try to put B into context, and I'll offer you an interpretation key for my following slides. So black background is review material, and white background is my own work. So basically, since I didn't really know who I was going to talk to, this kind of thing is for people that are not aficionados, but the aficionados may get bored at some point, so if they get bored, they can wake up when the white background come up, and if you're not an aficionado, you can go back to sleep when the white background come up, and then wake up again when the black background comes up. Okay. So what's the standard cosmological model? The standard cosmological model goes under the name of Lambda CDM model, and this is the cosmic pi that we've seen before. Numbers have changed by 1% or so because it's the change between WMAP, 3 years and 5 years things, but, 1%, at the 1% level, we don't worry. I mean, it's a big problem anyway. So the standard cosmological model is a spatially flat universe where the statistical properties of the primordial fluctuation gives you are Gaussian and gives you a power law primordial power spectrum. And only 6 parameters fits very well this universe. And here are the numbers from the WMAP 5 years analysis. And so notice the tiny error bars on these parameters, but what we are going to concentrate is on this parameter here, so tiny error bar to get rid of all this. But this model is not new, so it's not that the model came up when cosmology entered the precision era. It was around even before, and in fact, when the model started being proposed, this visually was the kind of the state of the art of cosmological observation. So this is the CFA galaxy redshift survey. Each dot is a galaxy. And this is the copy the MR map of the cosmic microwave background fluctuations. So this is, although this is a posteriori information, a map of the universe 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and this is a map of the universe approximately 14 giga years after the Big Bang, although again these numbers are a posteriori information. Now, we fast forward about 15 years or so and put an avalanche of data in the middle. And then what you get is that for what the cosmic microwave background is concerned, even visually you go from a data set that looks like this, this is the COBE map, to a data set that looks like this, which is the WMAP, temperature fluctuation map. So even visually you know that there's much more information here from respect to there. And for what the large scale structures are concerned, we went from a map like this to a map like that. When the little matchstick man that I showed you before would be fitted in this tiny little part here, and each of these points, and you know, this is, you know, below the resolution of the image, it's a galaxy. And there's even more information in there, in the sense that for each of these galaxies there are spectra. And spectra enclose a lot of information about the mechanism that actually created the galaxies from the underlying distribution of dark matter. So visually, you can see this way, where at each galaxy has been given a color, but there's even more information than the color there. There's an entire spectra of the light of the galaxy. So this survey, it's the photometric survey and the spectroscopic survey. So the spectroscopic survey is order of magnitude below that. But even in the photometric survey, you still have several different bands, so there's still some color.
How far out you can directly go in between these surveys?
What do you mean reliably? So, you know, measuring redshift, it's easy if you have a spectrum of an object. It's not that easy if you have photometry, and we are going to get back to this later on, because the redshift is going to be one of the key issue for something I want to tell you about. And also there is something that is called selection function. The farther you go, you see only the brightest objects, so you miss a lot of objects. So the main sample of Sloan arrives reliably to redshift around 0.2, but then there is a sample of luminous red galaxies that goes beyond that, and there is a quasar sample that goes even beyond that. And for what the cosmic microwave background is concerned, the new things in 2007 was that to this map some airlines were added, and the airlines are simply to illustrate that extra information has been measured, that is the polarization of the cosmic microwave background light has been measured, and it's indicated for this beauty shot by this line, and there's a lot of information about the primordial universe on that. So I think I convince you that there has been an avalanche of data, and even with this avalanche of data and high-precision cosmology, this model has survived. It's still valid. It still fit the data. So can we say something more about this dark energy where you don't know about something, you parameterize, and then you try to measure the parameter, and so a parameterization that has been widely used is the parameterization of the equation of state parameters for dark energy, which is pressure over density, which goes under the little letter of W. And here I show the constraint. This is the omega matter, the matter density parameter of the universe, versus this equation of state parameter, assuming that the universe is flat here, for several different data sets. Now, this is WMAP 3 years data, and these are supernovae from Rees and collaborator from 2004, that's the gold sample. And so you can see that the two likelihood contours, they cross there, and you can add other data set, you can add an Hubble parameter measurement from the HST key project prior, or you can add large scale structure and you still hover around that point. And then when the WMAP 5 years came along, then a similar plot was also produced, but now here there is omega lambda instead of omega matter, although if the universe is flat you can quickly convert one into the other. And still you find this qualitatively the same behavior. There's a large degeneracies if you look at the cosmic microwave background alone, the degeneracies get cut here by adding a prior on the Hubble constant at redshift zero. And then when you add other data set, this whole thing shrinks and shrinks with something that is consistent with the value of a cosmological constant. So you may want to ask, if the CMB was so powerful in giving us omega matter, omega baryon, the ratio, NS, and all this, why do we get so weak constraint about the nature of arc energy from the cosmic microwave background? And so, just to give you an idea, you can, it's easy to show that if you want to reconstruct dark energy in a non-parametric way, say it's a slowly rolling scalar field and you want to reconstruct the potential in a non-parametric way, or you want to reconstruct W as a function of redshift in a non-parametric way, then the quantity that you need to measure as a function of redshift is actually H dot. So it's the time derivative of the Hubble parameter as a function of redshift. And as far as I know, there is no observable that can give you H dot. There are observables that can give you Hz, but not H dot. So it's clear the limitation of the cosmic microwave background. And now, I'd show you this degeneracy, but if you now say that the universe may be not flat, then this degeneracy opens up a lot more. So the limitation of the CMB is that the CMB is located at one given redshift. It's located at redshift 1090, and that's it. And so in order to know something more about dark energy, you need to look at the expansion history of the universe. And to look at the expansion history, you need to know to have more than one snapshot. So we have several options there to do that. And so let's look at the symptoms of dark energy, that is the observational effects. One thing that is the reason why it was discovered, the acceleration of the universe in 1998, is the plot of the recession velocity versus brightness of standard candle being supernovae. And the other things that really confirmed this was the location of the cosmic microwave background acoustic peaks. But this measured the angular size distance to last scattering. And when you look at large-scale structure, you can measure two things. One thing is the angular size distance to the typical redshift of your survey, but you can also measure the amplitude of perturbations, of cosmological fluctuation today, and then you or at the effective redshift of the survey, and then this can be compared with the cosmic microwave background perturbation amplitude. And I color-coded these observables in different ways because they probe different things. Here, one is probing the expansion history of the universe, and here one is probing the history of the growth of fluctuations. And I'm sure Roy will tell you and repeat again that if you rely on Einstein gravity, on standard gravity, then this implies this and this implies this. But if you drop that, then there is not anymore a one-to-one correspondence between these two things. So what is the leading observational technique to go after dark energy today? Well, first, the supernovae. This is the tried and tested method. And the supernovae test the expansion history. Then the next observational techniques that comes to mind is galaxy cluster number count. Galaxy clusters are the biggest cosmological structures that are visualized today. They're very rare objects. And so they have information, they carry information about the growth of structure. And in the next slide, I'm going to intuitively show you why, and I'm going to write one equation. Then an emerging technique is the weak lensing technique. That is, if you have a mass between you and a source, the light from the source is going to be gravitationally lensed, so you have a way to actually measure the mass that is in the middle. And so weak lensing probes a combination between the growth of structure and geometry and expansion history, because you have this geometry effect, where is the lens and where is the source. And then another emerging technique, which I'm going to talk about more later on, is what is called baryonic acoustic oscillation. This is based on having a very accurate three-dimensional map of the galaxy distribution. And this probes, again, the expansion history of the universe. And if you don't know what this is, we're going to get back to this in a second. And then a question for you. A combination of technique will be best for at least two reasons. And I'll let you think about the reasons. So the astrotype people are actually doing their part on this. So this will be a very incomplete list of observational effort that is going on. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and I could be going. But let's go back to our point here. So did I say weak dark energy constraint on the cosmic microwave background? Because the cosmic microwave background is located at a given redshift. But actually, if we really think about it, the CMB encloses information about the growth of foreground structure. It's just not through the primary CMB. It's through what are called the secondary CMB anisotropies. And so let's spell them out. So the first thing that comes to mind is what is called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. That is, if you have a photon that travel through a gravitational potential perturbation, and if the universe is not Einstein the sitter, while the photon is crossing it, that perturbation is going to evolve and it's going to change, so it's going to leave an imprint on the cosmic microwave background of the fact that when the photon enters the perturbation changes, and then when it exits, the perturbation is different. And so the first detection of the Sachs-Wolfe effect actually came out very shortly after the first year WMAP result came out, and Rob Crittenden was in that work and collaborators. And then the other things is the other secondary effect that actually are going to show up not at the very largest scales, but small angular scales. And this effect was under the name of the Sanai-Zeldovich effect, the thermal one, the kinetic Sanai-Zeldovich effect, the Riesz-Schama effect, and Lenzing. So I won't have time to go through all of this. I'll mention something about the kinetic Sanai-Zeldovich effect and the Riesz-Schama effect. And then the next thing you may want to ask yourself is, well, the CMB works so well because we could see their peaks. And then what if we could see the peak pattern also a lower redshift and get a lot of other things also for free? And then, of course, you can resort to other probes. So let me say something about galaxy clusters number count. So galaxy clusters are rare events, and the probability of a cluster of mass m redshift z is directly proportional to something that is in an exponential. So there's a lot of sensitivity there because these things are in an exponential. And in here, you have this quantity that is the RMS of fluctuation smoothed on a given scale that correspond to the mass of the object you are looking at. So in here, there's information about the growth of structure. So if you have a one-dimensional representation of the density fluctuation, which is this, so that's the position x, that's delta, the overdensity, and then you say object forms only above this line, right? Then as time evolves, then the density perturbation grows, and then at some point, well, they cross this line and they form objects. So there is information about the growth of perturbation in there. But you have to be aware of systematics. Systematic goes under the colloquial question, what was the mass of that cluster? There's a mass here, but it's not given to actually assert the mass. So there are several options to actually assert the mass of the clusters, and one interesting possibility is to go after weak Lenzing of the cluster or Lenzing of the clusters, and you can do this in two ways. You can either send something in space and measure, get rid of the atmosphere and measure very, very accurately the tiny distortion on background galaxies that the clusters will impress on those galaxies. But if you do that, you can show that you can only measure the mass of very massive clusters. And the other possibility, now again, for the non-aficionados, we'll get into the technical details, is to actually do it from the ground, but then stack the images. That is, you put together the signal for many, 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 many clusters that have lower masses, and then you improve the statistics this way. And this is not a new idea, but we did the calculation with a graduate student of mine, and basically it turns out that since the distribution, the number of objects as a function of mass is very, very steep, and there are many, many, many more objects with low mass than objects with very high mass, then this helps you a lot to beat down the statistical error. But there's another technique that is really good and really easy to actually get the mass of the cluster. That is called the thermal Sanai-Zeldovich effect. So here you have the cosmic microwave background, and there you have hot electron in a cluster, and then where the CMB photon goes through the clusters, they get distorted. because there are very hot electrons in the middle. And the kind of distortion you have, you can see it because it imprints a frequency-dependent signal distortion in the cosmic microwave background. And the location of the cluster is not a black body anymore. And that distortion gives you a pretty robust indication of the mass of the clusters. And I'm going to put this here because this is going to be big in the next few months, because there are at least two or three large experiments that are after this technique. And I know they have data. They're just writing the papers. But the other technique I'm going to talk about is something that is called the kinetic Snedel-Dovich effect. So if this hot gas is moving with respect to the cosmic microwave background frames, then you're going to have another effect on top of that. And the effect is called the kinetic effect. Now, the photons are going to be distorted, but the distortion you're going to have is going to have the same frequency dependent as the cosmic microwave background, but it's going to imprint extra fluctuation on it. And so you are measuring the cluster bulk velocity field at low redshift. And the interesting things of this is that the growth of the velocity encloses information about the expansion history of the universe and about the growth of perturbation. So if you write down the expression of the velocity-velocity power spectrum, which is what you can measure with this kinetic Snedel-Dovich effect, then you will find out that there is something here, which is the growth of perturbation, and something here, which is our old friend, the Hubble parameters as a function of redshift. So there's information there about dark energy. And the cool thing is that it turned out that with different survey strategy, whether you do a survey that is wide and shallow or do a survey that is narrow and deep, you're going to measure this effectively at different redshift. So by adjusting your survey strategy, you can actually get some information, some differential information about the redshift evolution of that energy. Yes. Okay, so you know where the clusters are. So you know that if there's a cluster there, then there should be the effect. And so you know what signal you're looking for. You don't know the amplitude, but you know where it is. So that's how you can disentangle it. Right, although it's not, since we have some constraint on deviation from Gaussianity and the constraints are pretty strong, then it doesn't affect that much your conclusions. But that's a good question. Okay, how much time do I have? Oh, okay. So then the other thing I want to mention, it's another effect, that is the Riesz-Schama effect, and I'm going to pair it up with Lenzing, and now we are going to see why. So if I write down the delta T over T in one direction, gamma in the sky of the cosmic microwave background, I'm going to write it as a primordial term, a term due to Lenzing, a term due to the fact that something like the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect is happening all the time to the photons that are coming to you from the cosmic microwave background, except that the ISW effect, the integrated Sachs-Wolfe, assumes the structure are growing linearly. But we know that as you go to smaller and smaller scale, where the density contrast gets closer to 1, then they cannot grow linearly. They need to grow non-linearly. So even this non-linear growth must give an imprint into the cosmic microwave background because, well, the potential is changing while the photon crosses it. And so this goes under the name of Riesz-Schama effect. And so this effect depends on omega matter. And again, our old friends, the W parameter. So how are we going to, say, see this effect? So the idea is to couple the high redshift universe, the primordial CMB signal, with the low redshift universe. So the primordial signal is a large scale. The low redshift universe, a high L small scale, via the weak Lenzing signals. because the same structure that gives you weak lengthing of the CMB, which it's very, very difficult to detect on its own, is the structure that gives you this Rishama. And it's distort the primary, because the primary acts as a backlight illumination of these foreground structures. So the quantity to use is the equivalent of the three-point correlation function, but now in spherical harmonics. And if you consider the coupling between primordial lengthing and Rishama effect, it's the leading term after the effect from the thermal Sonnier-Zeldovich, but the thermal Sonnier-Zeldovich can be taken out because it's got its own frequency-dependent way. All the other effects don't have frequency-dependent. The other effect looks like black body. The LC thermal does not. So with frequency information, that contribution can be subtracted out. And then there are two competing contributions, the decay of gravitational potential in non-Einstein de Sitter universe and the amplification due to non-linear gravitational evolution. And also, both of them depend on omega matter and W, and the balance depends on omega matter and W. So you can do some forecasts, and depending how aggressive you want to be with your bias spectrum, that is, how many triangle shape you want to consider and how many you want to keep to yourself for systematic check, you can get better or worse constraint. So this is a very conservative constraint, assuming a forecast from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is a high resolution project to do a high resolution map of the cosmic microwave background and W map. But other people are trying to do the same for, and being a little bit more aggressive on keeping different combination of L, and you can get very strong constraint also on the time evolution of that parameter. Sorry. Yes. Yes. Okay. So this term as subdominant compare. So this is the leading order term. So they will be there, but they should go into the error bar, and it should go at a subdominant level compared to all the other ones.
So the analysis of the next slide.
Is just considering this first term. It's just ignoring everything else, yes. Okay, so the two, the experiment I was mentioning that are going to give us a lot of cluster seen with the thermal Sonnier-Zeldovich effect, let me mention one of them. So the other one is the South Pole Telescope, but the one I'm closer to is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and you can find more information there, and you'll probably recognize somebody in this picture, and this guy's Lyman Page is the PI of the whole experiment. And this, just to show you that the telescope is working, is an image of the bullet cluster seen in the thermal Sonnier-Zeldovich effect. Those are the colored contour, and overimposed are from the Flamingo collaboration that did the compilation, the X-rays contour of the cluster and the weak lengthing contour of the cluster. So, can't say much more than that, but the thing is working. So, result will come out hopefully soon. So, let me go back and ask again, so did they say weak dark energy constraint from the CMB, and now I went through these first 2 points. What if one could see the peak pattern also at lower redshifts? And so this goes under the name of baryonic acoustic oscillations. And now I probably, here it's an animation of evolution of a single perturbation, although you need to imagine a superposition. For those of you thinking real space, if you think in Fourier space, the next slide is for you. So these are perturbations in dark matter, gas, that is baryons, photons, and neutrinos. So let's forget about the neutrinos for the moment. So notice that as long as the gas and the photons are coupled, they travel together, but then at some point they decouple, so the photon keeps streaming, but the baryon find themselves offset with respect to the dark matter perturbation, but then gravity evolves, and gravity doesn't distinguish between dark matter and baryons, and so far away of a given amount, and now we're going to see what the given amount, a slight overdensity of dark matter is going to be created to match this overdensity of baryons. And then give it a few billion years, then galaxies form, following the dark matter over densities. And so this thing here should show up in the galaxy distribution. So in other words, you should see that galaxies are preferably separated by a given amount, which is how far away this perturbation, that is sound, it was traveling at the speed of sound back then, could travel between when you put down the perturbation and when photons and baryon decouple. So for those of you who don't think in real space and think in Fourier space, let me just repeat the thing in Fourier space. So we have the C and B acoustic peaks because before the last scattering surface, photons and baryon were tightly coupled, and there were dark matter over densities, and therefore you have anacoustic waves there. So gravity compresses, and then the baryons are represented by these little masses, and a pressure that are the photons makes this acoustic oscillation, and this is what creates the acoustic peaks in the cosmic microwave background. And then after recombination, right, the photons stream free, that's why you see the cosmic microwave background. But if and the baryons still have this imprint there. But if baryons are 1/6 of the dark matter, then this baryonic oscillation should leave some imprint in the dark matter distribution. And those are the wiggle you're going to go after in the galaxy distribution. The cool thing is that this has been seen. So for those of you who think in real space, this is from the Sloan collaboration, commoving separation and correlation function of galaxies multiplied by, you know, the distance square. And that's what you are looking for. That peak there at about 100 and something megaparsec. And then in Fourier space, this is what it looks. That's the P of K as a function of K. And here you see the matter radiation equality, but here are the peaks you are looking for. And then you see it much better if you actually divide this by a smooth function and then you enhance these peaks. Well, the problem is that it will look like a bubble if you had only one perturbation, but you have to imagine a superposition of many of them. So you can't actually point there and see, I have like a bull eye. So no, because there's more than one perturbation and they are all... I don't know if you get phase cancellation, but if you Fourier transform yourself, then you can see that this should give you some... wiggles, because it's ringing, like you have one feature and therefore in Fourier space it gives you some ringing.
No, there is the Great Wall.
So if you Fourier space language is that over rho at that scale at k equal to 150 megaparsec distance, would you expect a slightly larger delta over rho than just coming from?
Yes, that's exactly what you see here.
Right. How much larger is it?
It's small. It's small. Yeah. The baryons are 1/6 of the dark matter, so it's got to be small. And that's one of the reasons why we couldn't see it until 2005. There were many claims, but at least two claims of having detected it before then. That's one reason, and the other reason is that it's on very large scales, so you need to survey a very large volume, and when you go to Fourier space, you know what you measure is the convolution of the true things and the window function. So if you don't know very well your window function, you will see wiggles, I guarantee you, but they're not going to be primordial. So, okay, so this technique is quite robust, and it's insensitive to many systematics, so it's a very, very promising technique. And actually with this technique, you can do two measurements in one. So the challenge of this technique is that the scales of interest are of the order of 100 megaparsecs, so you need to survey extremely large volumes. But the feature of this technique is that if you have a good enough three-dimensional galaxy distribution, you can measure both the angular size distance and the Hubble parameter as a function of redshift from three-dimensional clustering. How does it work? Well, on the line of sight, if you write down the relation between dr and dz, where z here is the redshift, here comes again our old Hubble as a function of redshift on the line of sight. But on the plane of the sky, you have a standard ruler. You're seeing the standard ruler as several different redshifts. You actually do exactly what you did in the cosmic microwave background, but as several different redshifts. And you measure an angular size distance to that redshift. And this is an integrated measurement of h of z, but this is a direct measurement of h of z. So you can do plots like this, that you translate the percentage error in your dark energy parameters as a function of the percentage error in either plane of the sky measurement and line of sight measurement. And then you can basically read here that to get the, as a function of redshift to have a given error here, you need to measure this to 1%, or you need to measure this. So it's a hard measurement. You need to do better than percent measurement. It's going to be tough. Yes. So if you have a standard ruler, and you know what your standard ruler is, it's this feature in the correlation function. And you know the standard ruler, but you can measure of that standard ruler is different in redshift. So say, this galaxy has one end of the ruler, this other galaxy is at the other end of the ruler. I don't measure the distances, but I measure the redshift. Then you can convert that to measure that, you know, so you get h of z. So you need a very accurate three-dimensional distribution of your galaxies. So this measurement that we're going to see, it's easier to do than this measurement. Now you're going to see what it would take to do both. So let's go back to spectroscopy or photometry. So the goal here is to survey a large number of galaxies and extremely large volumes. And so when you want to, so to measure galaxy redshift, you have two techniques. You have the spectroscopy technique and the photometry technique. In the spectroscopy technique, you just measure the spectrum of a galaxy. There are a lot of features in the spectrum of a galaxy. And then if your template spectrum is the black one, for example, or then the black one, as you redshift it, it's going to move this way. And so you can fit the redshift by fitting all these features. One way. And the other way is to do exactly the same, but now it's like if you had much lower resolution, so you are smoothing, you're averaging, and then you measure basically photometry. So say I put a beam here, and a beam here, and a beam there, and measure the shift that way. Now, these techniques allow very quickly to cover a lot of sky, and then you can do weak lensing for free with this kind of technique, and many, many, many galaxies. But the redshift error you get here is large because your resolution is bad. This, you need many million galaxies, but it's going to take a very long time to go after them because you have to go one by one and get the spectrum. But the error in redshift here is completely negligible. It's tiny. So the debate here is still open. So I'm going to mention two examples. One is what I call the ultimate survey for baryonic acoustic oscillations, and it's complementary to ground-based approaches, and it's called ADEPT, Advanced Dark Energy Physics Telescope, and it's going to go after 100 million galaxy redshift, a redshift between 1 and 2, cover a volume of the order of 100 cubic gigaparsecs, and also supernovae, measure both H of Z and dA. And it's a proposed NASA mission that was approved, at least for preliminary development studies. But what I want to concentrate more on is a new survey that was recently proposed and recently funded that is called Physics of the Accelerating Universe. So it's a close collaboration between particle physicists, theorists and experimentalists, and astrophysicists, theorists and observers. And that's one of the goals of this project. It's also to make all these people work happily together. It was awarded a Consolidated Ingenio Grant very recently, and Enrique Fernandez is the PI. And the technique uses an hybrid technique. It's called narrowband photometry. It's like doing a low-resolution spectrum, but you can go fast enough and get many, many, many galaxies. And it could be the best of both worlds if we manage to make it work. So we'll see why. The idea is to cover 10,000 square degrees, a ratio between 0.1 and 1 roughly, and get 14 million luminous red galaxies population, but hundreds of millions of all other type of galaxies. Likely we'll need a dedicated telescope. For sure we'll need a new camera, because we need at least 40 narrowband filter. But if we do that, the goal is to measure both H of Z and DA of Z. And these are the institutions involved that are sharing this Consolidated Ingenio. So what's the idea? The idea is to define a new photometric system. So this is the combination of atmosphere and a telescope and coating and mirror and stuff that do to your throughput. But all these different colors define your bands. So this is a broad band, this is a broad band, but these are a lot of narrow band. And if I take the spectrum of a galaxy, a typical model of a galaxy of some 11 giga-years old luminous red galaxies at redshift 0.2, and I convolve it with what this will give me, it will look now, offset for clarity, like this green line. Remember, redshift moves things this way, and so you can fit the redshift by fitting this feature, this feature, this feature, and this feature. So that's a lot of work defining a new photometric system. Right now, basically routine is to use 4 to 6 broadband filters, but there are examples of using more filters. One example is it's a combo 17. Some of you may be familiar with it because of the Wicklensing combo 17 measurement, and this is an example of their filters. Note that their filter actually overlap. So you have a broad one, and under the broad one, for example, here you have 3 narrower one. And the other example that is sort of halfway between this and what we are planning to do is the Alhambra survey, where now you see that the filters are almost top hat, and they have 20 narrowband filters. So it will be, say, one step beyond this Alhambra survey. And I know that the Alhambra collaboration is bright in the papers. So results from this survey will come out pretty soon. So what filters and how can I, with this, get enough signal to actually measure both the DA and H of Z? So the idea is that the broader the filters are, the bigger is your error in redshift, and the narrower the filters are, the smaller is your error in redshift. And you don't want to throw away photons and throw away resources, but you do want to have enough resolution that you can do what you need to do. So you need to figure out first what redshift resolution you need, and second, how you get it. And so a lot of work is going on this. So let me show you what we've learned so far. So how would a redshift error degradation, due to the fact that you don't have a spectrum, you have a low resolution spectrum, will affect your measurement? So this is a zoom in. Let's concentrate here on the correlation function, again, multiplied by this R square here to see the wiggle better as a function of separation. For a simulation, this is 1 million halos above 3.7 × 10^13 solar masses from the MAIA simulation, which is stands for Millennium simulation from ETHE, which is the institution. And it's a 27 gigaparsec cube. So this dotted line is the prediction from linear theory. This solid black line is the renormalization group prediction for when you add nonlinearities, right? Nonlinearities, couple modes, and if they couple modes and you have a sharp feature, that sharp feature is going to be broadened. this red one is the effect you get by introducing an uncertainty in your redshift measurement, which is of this amount. Why this amount was chosen is because the width of this curve is of the order of 15 megaparsec moving, and so 15 megaparsecs correspond roughly to this redshift error. And also, this redshift error can be achieved with the narrow band photometric system collaboration. And if you degrade this by another factor of 2, then this wiggle starts almost disappearing. And so, yes, I do dream with this number. I think I'll skip this because I want to tell you something else. And so, basically, you can compare this kind of survey with other surveys that are in the market. But what I want to say here is that you can get a lot of other science about it. And one thing I want to measure is that you can't do dark energy with baryonic acoustic oscillation without going also after galaxy formation. So you can get and try at least to kill two birds with one stone, the stone being the same experiment. They are aiming for slightly lower redshift and for many less galaxies.
And a high
redshift component through the quasars and through the assortion line of the quasars. So the two techniques are highly, I believe they are highly complementary, because one technique goes after luminous red galaxies and this new technique of the assortion from the quasar, while this technique goes after all the galaxies. And it will be very interesting to check that one gets the same answer independently on the type of galaxies one selects. And I'll be happy to see if this actually is true. Okay. And so one thing I want to briefly mention, if I have some time, is primordial non-Gaussianity. Why do I want to mention this? Well, because lately there has been a big deal about primordial non-Gaussianity. And here is a slide that I steal from Eiichiro's Komatsu WMAP 5 years talk, to which I have added the claim detection from Yadav and Van Delt for some primordial non-Gaussianity at the 95% confidence level. And so when I mean non-Gaussianity, I mean that the primordial potential fluctuation is a Gaussian plus something proportional to the square of a Gaussian. And now this kind of thing can be motivated by inflation, although when you say non-Gaussian, it's like saying non-dog, and it could be anything. And in fact, even in Eiichiro's own talk, the non-Gaussianity is divided in local, which is this, and equilateral, which cannot be actually written like that. You have to write it directly in Fourier space. Yes, sure.
In the context of inflation, how much does the data allow for the primordial amplitude to deviate from 10 to the minus 5 if you assume such a profile? Say for like the simplest,
Okay, so the simplest inflationary model wants an FNL that is basically unmeasurable. But it's also true that, as far as I understand, a lot of inflationary models that were proposed lately, they all end up with some FNL that could be measurable. So you don't know if there is a sociological thing there, that if you end up with a paper where you say, this is measurable, I write the paper, or if there's some... I don't know. I'm just showing you the data.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Is there a direct relation between one and the other one? No. Yes? Okay, so there is a relation between, in single fields, or blah, 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 between epsilon and eta, which gives you n, and FNL.
Yes.
But the models that have been proposed are well beyond that. So we shouldn't actually just concentrate on this. But you know, people that actually work directly on inflation will be able to actually motivate this much better than I can.
But as a model and a statement, those two things.
Yeah. And so basically this created a lot of excitement, and when it was announced at a conference, everybody, and I know if there's anybody of you that was actually at that conference, started rewriting their talk when this was announced. And so basically we now know that the prospect for actually deciding between inflationary model based on the primordial background of gravity waves are difficult. Because there are a lot of inflationary models out there which have a non-detectable background of gravity waves. And so by talking to people in the corridor in the coffee break in meetings, I have the impression that now they are taking Gaussianity, non-Gaussianity more seriously and say, well, maybe if we have to discriminate between inflationary models, we should do this, but we should also do the non-Gaussianity. And so this was a long story to introduce an example of what you can do of other science with this large galaxy survey. And an example is the clustering of peaks that are dark matter halos of non-Gaussian density field. So you can show that if you have a non-Gaussianity of this sort, it introduces some biasing on very large scale on the shape of your galaxy power spectrum, of your halo power spectrum. In other words, your halo power spectrum on very large scales starts blowing up. And this is something that wasn't realized until a few months ago. And so there are two papers, Adalal et al., and one I'm directly involved with. And so that's the effect, and you can even write it for more general non-Gaussianity. And just, you know, to write an equation here and there, I show you here the expression for the fractional correction to the power spectrum due to this effect for a general non-Gaussianity described by a bispectrum that is here. How does it change if you change the FNL? It's, this thing is directly proportional to FNL. But it depends on redshift, and it depends a little bit on the mass of the halo you're considering. This is the fractional correction, but I put an FNL of 100, and I put it probably a redshift 0.5 or so. So you have of the order of 100% effect if FNL is 100, and you can look at those scales. We're running simulation to actually check that this is indeed the case, because you do to do everything analytically, you need to do some approximations, and you want to check those approximations. But and I don't have plots yet, but the simulation looks good, looks pretty well described.
Calculation, the idea is forget about details like
the inflationary model or anything like that. Just suppose that there is a non-Gaussian. Yes. What will be the effect on the clustering of halos?
Does it depend on the details and how this can
Yes. Yes. But it's just to show you an example of other things that you can do for free once you have one of these large next generation galaxy surveys. So I think my time is up, so I'm not going to say a lot about this cosmic clock. Let me just say that if you had a way to measure how time passes as a function of redshift, you will have yet another measurement of the Hubble parameters as a function of redshift. So if you could find a lot of cosmic clocks around the universe, you could do that. And the idea that we proposed here was to use as a cosmic clock all the passively evolved galaxies. Because they are bright, you can see them far away, and how you can find what their age is, and because you have observational indication that they all form at the same time, about 1 giga-year after the Big Bang, and that since then they evolve passively. So if you can do that and select those galaxies and get a high enough resolution spectra of them, you can get their age, and you can do the age redshift relation. And so we started a program to go at Keck and actually get a lot of those spectra. And so let me skip this. These are the present from archival data measurement of Hubble as a function of redshift. And so we went many times to Keck, and we had a tornado, earthquakes that almost got away with the Keck, a tsunami warning, and fires. But after that, we got data. And we are reusing the data, and so watch this space. So I'm going to skip all this, and I'm going to give you the summary. The standard cosmological model, I think I convinced you that is extremely successful, but it leaves us with a big puzzle. Observation indicate that nothing weighs something, but much less than what you would naively expect, and makes the universe accelerate. Now, other options are still possible, maybe homogeneities or gravity, but whatever it is, the result must look pretty much like a lambda. One question for discussion: what would it take to discriminate among all these possibilities? I think I convinced you that there is an heroic observational effort ongoing, and we learn a lot not only about dark energy from this effort, but I think we have to ask, how interesting is it really to add yet another significant figure to lambda or to W? We add yet another significant figure, what does it mean? And my personal view is that the answer lies in the interface between astronomy and theoretical physics. So if we decide to take what I call the accelerating universe challenge, then we have no other way. Now, we may decide not to take it. So what are the challenges of the accelerating universe? Again, my personal take on this that we should discuss. We create a culture of particle physicists and astronomers working together, theory and experimentalists, and I know this is not easy because the culture and the way of actually going after science and developing science is completely different. And sometimes I say when you try to run a group of theoretical particle physicists like you would run a group of astrophysicists, it's a little bit like herding cats. On the other hand, they think that our group are being run like the military service. So, yeah. Now, first order challenge, why is lambda so small? I think the astronomers have done their job there. They've measured it. So now I think the ball is on the other court. Second order challenge, is it dynamical? Or does it evolve? Or could we have it wrong all along? I think by now, I don't think anybody seriously convinced that the observations are wrong. But you can interpret this question as, did Einstein have the last word on gravity, or did FRW have the last word on the metric? And finally, the data challenge, because there is an avalanche of data coming soon, and we'll have to deal with it. And it's not going to be easy. It's probably going to go faster that Murphy's law on how fast the computers grow. So we are going to clash with a problem. And the systematic errors in many cases will be the limit. So we have to think when we start an experiment how to deal with systematic error, because we are trying to measure very, very, very tiny effects. And so I leave you with the advertisement for a workshop that I'm organizing in Florence, and I think it may be interesting for this kind of audience. It's called New Horizons in Cosmology, and it's going to run in Florence, very close to where Galileo lived, between January and March 2009. Thank you. Well, H has got to change as you go in redshift. It's got to change, but it may deviate. You may read in the data that it deviates from the lambda CDM prediction. I think we should read this and repeat it many times and write it on our mirror in the morning and read it every day. I think we need to be extremely careful. And that's one of the reasons why I said that you want to have several different approaches looking at the same thing, because that's the best way you can find out whether there are systematics affecting your data. No. No.
Correlated, since in your last statement here, since you're one of the original architects of the WMAP data and dealing with WMAP third year, maybe whatever, but in your work on that, you guys, you know, noticed some patterns that seem to have persisted, even some systematic issues. It's not clear that it's systematic errors or what it is. How does your experience with that, relate to your expectations for, the persistence of those systematic errors? And what I'm going to be more specific about in that question. There seems to be some people, our colleagues down at my friends down at Case Western, who want to say that, there's some sort of, they see some preferred frame, some preferred access effect that still can't be undone. Now, one way of getting away from that is to say that there is some intrinsic non-Gaussianity on large scales, for example. And that's kind of why I was kind of pressing on that issue.
Okay.
Could you turn it on and say we actually want to lift this preferred frame effects with the future data?
Okay.
You would just start seeing the persistence of those systematics. I think it's running out by then.
Okay. So, let me go through the number of systematics that have been discussed in the literature, and then let's go through. One feature that was seen from the very beginning is the following. This low L seems to be lower than expected in a simple lambda CDM universe, especially the quadruple. And this was the reason, by the way, why COBE estimate an NS of 1.2 to 1.4, and now NS is more closer to 0.96 to 0.95. It's because COBE measure only this, and then if you have this point here, of course, it gives you a high NS. And this was the reason why a joint analysis between COBE and Archeop was done before the WMAP data came out. Then the COBE normalization was used to then calibrate Archeops. Archeops Vaina balloon experiment didn't cover the whole sky, so only could cover up to here. And then the match was done, and the whole Archeops was brought down. And so the amplitude was lower, and it's again this effect. Now, the other feature that was discussed was this wiggle. So there seems to be, now these are band towers, so it's different to say there's a feature here. There was the bite here, and there's another feature here that is actually very significant, but when you plot it in band power, you don't see it, so nobody wrote about it. And then basically related to the low quadruple, then it was noted that the low multiple, if you look at the, actually instead of looking at this, that you the phase information get lost because it's a power spectrum, so you angle average. If you don't look at the angle average, so you look at the ALM, there seems to be a correlation between the orientations. And so for the case of the quadruple, the two things are actually related, because it turns out that basically, a lot of the power that you are missing here seems to be correlated with something that you cut out when you cut the galaxy, and then this amplitude of these things then depends on how you cut the galaxies, and so since all this seems to correlate, then people start thinking, well, maybe there is a preferential axis, etc., etc. What could it be? and what tools do you have to go after it? We have to keep in mind that this happens on the larger scales, and on the larger scales we have a fundamental limitation. We only have one universe. So we have what is called cosmic variance. You measure that, and you can't measure more, for one exception, which I'm going to say later on. And so one thing could be, well, it's foreground effect. If it's foreground effect, it needs to have a frequency dependent. If it's a frequency dependent, well, go after and measure many frequencies. Otherwise, we have not many other tools to actually go after it, unless you find a model that fits all this feature and also makes prediction. Then you tell somebody, now you go measure it. That person go measure it and get exactly what you predicted. Then you say, bingo, I was right. But unless you can do that, or until you can do that, I think we can keep discussing and discussing and discussing about it, but we'll never actually close the argument. There is one exception, however, is that, and now I don't have the reference in my brain, so if you want to look at the reference, I look it up and I tell you. So basically, when you look at clusters, clusters have hot electrons in them, and they see the local quadrupole of the CMB. And so in the polarization from clusters, you could actually see what was the quadrupole that they are seeing. So you can go, you can beat cosmic variance, and you can also try to do that a little bit with the CMB polarization. But again, if you look with the CMB polarization, again, you're looking at very large scales. So today, the very large polarization measurement are at the limit of not being noise dominated, but noise is still important. But in the future, once they become cosmic variance dominated, you can keep measuring and measuring and measuring, and you're not going to reduce your error bar. So there's some... That wouldn't help, because you are looking at smaller scales.
I would agree with what you said about the lower That doesn't tell you anything. It's just a predictor as a model that gives you the new feature and doesn't give you the one model because it's in the noise. So statistically, it's not a better thing.
Yeah. Well, we are entering a little bit of a difficult territory there, because you say it's in the noise, it's not statistically significant, but then some people would define statistically significant in different way. They will define it in terms of chi-square, and then that's one thing. They will define in terms of the Eikike measurement. They will define it in terms of Occam's razor. So then it becomes a little bit subjective. And also, it's a little bit of a posteriori statistics. So if you look at enough of them, then some of them are going to be 3 sigma. So...
Yeah, I think where John Matthew is, especially pressed on him on this, and he wanted to say that, no, it's a limit. Yeah, John Matthew definitely wants to several times, actually, just because of this answer.
Is there a difference between saying it's a real effect and there's a problem with land and CDM? Are those two different arguments or different statements?
It's a real effect is the argument that was made.
Yes, because in the ethos of discussion here, I would argue that quadruple point is not going to affect that land and CDM. The more you examine the CMB, the nicer the fit is. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
What's going to bring down land to CDN is the discovery of some super, super duper wave or something.
I just want to digress the question. Has there been a measurement of W using the Alcock-Pachinsky effect? And just a follow-up, can you say something more about supernova, radio galaxies, GRBs, and all the prospects of measuring W with them? All the techniques you presented as
okay, so...
Can I give the best one? I tried to, I would say I tried to do it, but you can use all my Jitsky to mention W. There's a very nice nature paper recently by the EBS team.
The BLTV was 18, I can't remember this person. Gutsu. Yes. And you can differentiate between different models, basically. Different cosmologies, that was not as much in here, but modified gravity is by doing
Is he doing Alcock Paczynski? Because Alcock Paczynski is that you have a standard rod, right? I think he's using beta, right? So he's using the growth of structure through beta. But I think the Alcock Paczynski you're basically doing it with baryon acoustic oscillation. You have a standard ruler. But the original idea was to use the broad shape of the power spectrum. But that's a very broad shape. So your error will also depend how broad your feature is. And again, it's an even larger scale. So your statistical error is going to blow up. And what was the other question? Well, sorry?
You didn't mention anything about supernova, FR2 radio galaxies. And
okay.
Because there have been FR2 radio galaxies work has been pioneered by FNC.
Yeah. Okay.
I've seen papers on GRBs also.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure that my intuition was correct in what you said about when you talk about the clusters, you're talking about on the order of 5 meter parsec scale. Going back to this, the possibility of the first frame effect. So if I look at photon signal coming in and there is some correlation between some Faraday rotation or some polarization.
No, sorry. So you have hot electrons,
yes.
And then to see the polarization, they should see a local quadrupole.
Yes. Good. And imagine I find some correlation between that and exactly correlations between the ALMs. Okay.
That'll be interesting. That'll be interesting.
There's a cross correlation, maybe an ED cross correlation or something like that. That would be a prediction.
I don't think it would do, but you should see that there is a correlation between the direction. So see if you can reconstruct what the local quadrupole was because you have enough clusters, and then you find that it's still aligned and you beat down the cosmic variance, and instead of being maybe 2 sigma, it becomes 15 sigmas, then you need to believe it. It's not that it's low. There is a specific pattern between the low multiples, and you could describe that pattern with a contrived model in which there is some gas or something like that, or you could describe with some features in the primordial. Yes. Yes, that they are aligned also. Yes. Yes.
So it's not just one point. Isn't it more, more interesting or more leading towards that there could be something there?
Yes, but again, we have to quantify the statistical significance of it. And then once you quantify the statistical significance, always remembering that it's a little bit of a posteriori statistics, then decide whether to lose sleep over it or not. And honestly, I wouldn't lose my sleep over it. I mean, I can lose my sleep over other things. And I do, but...
moving away from this low multiple.
I still have to go back to his question at the end. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so in 1 hour, I just wanted to concentrate on things that are considered the standard and for which a lot of missions are being planned, etc., and things that I've been directly involved with. But again, I think there should be as many different ways of measuring the same thing as possible. And if one technique is more prone of systematics, it shouldn't be thrown out of the window by itself. You maybe want to invest less money because probably the probability for success of that is going to be lower. But I don't think it's just a reason for throwing it out of the window, unless you can show that you are being dominated by systematics and what you're seeing is nonsense.
Are there huge
Well,
there was a seminar, I guess.
Okay. So I think anything that has got to do with the galaxies, and even my own stuff on the ages, should be taken very, very carefully and with, with tongs. Because galaxies are not as clean and nice as the physics that describe the CMB. So we need to take that seriously, but not for that reason we should throw the data and the measurement out of the window. So...
going back to some of the questions you were raising, whatever dark energy is, it should look like a cosmological constant, but it may be something else. And you were saying that, well, maybe how can we discriminate between them? So,
I thought we were going to discuss this in the discussion.
Well, at some point you have the sense of this non-Einstein de Sitter gravity.
So did Einstein have the last word?
Sorry?
Anything which is not matter dominated, you have phi which you also have.
Yes.
This is a non-scientific question. So I guess, does anyone know which of the three experiments is going to be chosen by JDM? I mean, whether it's SNAP or VAO or something.
I guess we will hear more now. We'll talk to the state. Like I think, what about, is this lambda dynamical? To me, that seems to me, okay, I'm going to be provocative the last 5 minutes. To me, it seems to me that that is much more interesting than why is lambda small. So, why do I say that? Well, I don't know, many things are small. If you look at the ratio of Newtonian gravitational constant versus semantic constant, it's 10 to the 40. And it has been with us, we wonder why is it so hard. I don't know, we just got used to it. So much, we don't use three coordinates. So I think that one could just say that lambda is small, and that's an observable parameter. Of course, if a theory explains it, fantastic. Just as if a new theory came and explained why, you know, the ratio of the semantic coupling, the gravitational coupling, the strong coupling is what it is, it's fantastic. But we don't lose sleep over it. But on the other hand, I think whether lambda is dynamical or not is a real issue. And so,
yes.
What are the constraints,
so right now the robust constraint we have, although we have tried to go beyond this, is just to say, well, if it's not lambda, then it's described by an equation of state parameter, and that's W. And so far, virtually all the measurements are consistent with minus one, with a cosmological constant. But why should W be constant? And at that point, the next step is to actually introduce a redshift parameterization of this variable. And there are some claims here and there, or maybe some indication that, but again, it's early times, it's early data, so you would have to see that at least the two independent measurements coincide and find the same evolution, and then you take it seriously.
I guess what types are at not sufficient sigma level, and I heard sometimes that if you cannot make a claim about the 5 or 6 sigma level, then I mean, I'm just saying that it's even when you parameterize with non-constant lambda,
right?
Non-constant
right. Right now, I think it's at the 2 point something sigma. So.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
That is minus one.
Right.
So is that the purpose of something like a depth? And would it be
a depth
or is it a SSD if you know that W1 is less than 5%?
Right. That's the idea, to basically try to measure they try to measure W as a function of redshift. And it really depends on what parameterization you use then. So whether you use the famous WWA parameterization or whether you do it in bins or you do it in a non-parametric way. So when you're usually trying to apply for funding or compare different experiments among each other, you just take a constant W and report the error bar. But different parameterization for different experiments can give you completely different results on the error bars. And By the way, yeah. Yep. Yes. Yes.
That is like saying, you know, God was writing this textbook about nature. On day one, wrote this formal expression. Day two, realized, oops, I'm in a mistake. I can't read it. Then I'm going to talk to you. I mean, there are perfect ways of writing conclusions in which Hamiltonian is completely well defined from day one. In which case, you don't introduce infinite energy and subtracting. Usually people immediately say, well, if we do that, however, what about casual effects? Well, you can't do casual effects doing everything finite. So I think this is a sociological thing, right? But of course, I mean, I would like to be shut down about this because almost everybody believes it's a real thing. So.
Well, that's a standard, the sort of standard picture, the best way of understanding it, according to the sociological
majority. I agree.
Theorists are very resourceful.
But have you even tried actually that's a
resource
one of the things? Yeah. Actually, modified gravity usually is quite safe for the same thing. You've got much more of a problem.
But what about the type of limiting energy that you need in CMB? I mean, in CMB, you need an omega matrix of 1. Sorry.
And all fundamental constants would change that too, and there's a big effort, observational effort also to go after that. Yeah. I think we should again look at the error bars. So, yeah, and then we should look at the error bars. And so, let's see if I have this plot here. Right, right, yes.
It's like the low
quarter I should write something else on the mirror every morning so we look at it. Let me write it here. That's the other thing. You have to write yourself in the mirror and look at it every morning. Beware of your priors. So when we actually say from two different papers, oh, I get a W that, or I get a W that, go and look at the priors that were used. Because sometimes CNB priors taken from Flatland CDM with NS equal 1 was used in one analysis, and in the other case, a different prior was used, and then you put the two together, and you end up with a 2 sigma evidence for something. And or one thing was marginalized and the other wasn't, or things like that. So, yes. No. I was just saying. I mean, look at this. It's not an easy measurement, right? So, and then I could show the same thing for the supernovae and actually try to do the exercise. Let's see if I find it. It's here. Oops. So these are the supernovae data, and actually depending on which supernovae you choose and how you combine them, this degeneracy more or less remain the same, but you can move along to this degeneracy a little bit, which makes you think that right now, if you plot all your contours, then your systematics are below the statistical errors, but as you start shrinking your statistical error, then... But of course, you never go and beat your systematics below your statistical error, because it's a lot of work and you don't do it if they are below your statistical error anyway. So
I guess this is follow-up. When you take all the data, everything, CMP, sigma, anything else, what sigmas is, how many sigmas is the evidence for an acceleration? I mean, the reason I asked is 2002 in the review, there was a modern physics paper by Peebles and Rathram, and they claimed the evidence is only 2 sigmas. Recently, they have papers by
For a lambda, you say?
Yeah.
I think we can do it by eye. And this is, sorry, well, let me see. Okay, I don't have it here. If you take all the data together and you work within the lambda CDM model and you believe your Hubble parameter, etc., then it's many sigma. I don't know how they got to 2 sigma.
Okay.
So for example, if you take the CMB alone and actually you allow your Hubble constant free, then you can live with a universe that is matter dominated, but you have to live with an Hubble constant of 30. And I don't know how many of us would truly believe that the Hubble constant is 30. So...
just a slight number of piece of paper and give it to me. I'm telling them all.
Okay, then let us thank Alicia for a beautiful